What does it mean when you hear hoot, hoot coming from a nearby tree this time of year? It means, I'll be home for Christmas. I don't know what it is about the Christmas holiday, the excess, the solemnity, or the righteous collision of the sacred and the secular, but it always brings out the worst in me. The worst jokes, that is. I don't consider them bad at all. I'm more of a storyteller than a joke writer, but I regard a well-composed joke to be an admirable accomplishment, even one that begins with the two-syllable trumpet call of many truly bad jokes, that being the knock-knock jokes, such as, knock-knock, who's there? Javier. Javier who? Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Hi, I'm Chris Rodell, and this is your Use All the Crayons podcast, coming to you today from the second floor ballroom right here at the heart of the fabulous Tin Lizzy in Youngstown, Pennsylvania. Today is going to include horns honking, engines revving, and the mournful sounds of pedestrians getting run over by truckers too impatient to wait for the one stoplight to turn green. I promise we'll cover any breaking news should we hear sirens. Today, sprinkled amidst the Christmas jokes, are stories about the snows in Buffalo, why some cities should change their names to be more representative of their circumstances, and the controversial Paul McCartney Christmas tune. And this is Use All the Crayons podcast. I'm putting together a troop of tiny sideburned toy makers to head to Las Vegas and sing Jailhouse Rock, Burnin' Love, etc. Ladies and gentlemen, give it up for Elvis Presley. This is a story I wrote in 2015 about the snows in Buffalo. I think in the interest of accuracy, it's time we rename Buffalo. Let's call it uninhabitable New York. The last few days have proven humans aren't meant to live in Buffalo. Heck, the last few days have proven that Buffalo aren't meant to live in Buffalo. The only silver lining I can see is that the city need not worry about any more lake effect snow. I can't imagine there's any lake left. They've already exceeded their typical snowfall for winter, which in Buffalo ends, I think, July 5th, or 2 days before winter begins. I'm horrified by what I see from western New York. It, to me, looks like hell. By now, other cities would be making snowmen. In Buffalo, they'll be making snow Godzillas. I remember 5 years ago when it was so bad in Buffalo, the almighty NFL canceled a game. A game. 1963 played all its games in the wake of a presidential assassination that left many fearful the Soviets were preparing a full-scale nuclear attack. So on one hand, you have the threat of mutually assured mass nuclear destruction being less threatening to human life than snow in Buffalo. If I lived in Buffalo, I'd right now be considering moving somewhere more moderate. Like Cleveland. I understand a sentimental attachment to the land on which you were born, but not when that land is buried beneath 7 feet of snow. That's why, truth in advertising, Buffalo should be required to change its name to uninhabitable. It would let people know not to move there unless you're skilled in igloo construction. Of course, Buffalo is not the only city that ought to be renamed. For years, I've argued New York should change its name to New and Improved York. I love spending time in New York and remember when it used to be like back in the good old days when making a good impression meant a really deep dent in the skull. I've never felt Los Angeles was a good name for a city where so few angels dwell. Well, alternatives, Los Gangbangers, Los Lousy Sequel Producers, are clunky. But the city is in home to more angelic-looking women and men than any place on the planet. That these people are uniformly duplicitous and conniving gender-neutral whores, that factors in too. That's why we ought to change Los Angeles into Los Angeles. I understand Boise, Idaho is a beautiful town. One story says Boise comes from the exclamation of a French-speaking guide when he spied the verdant valley over the rugged mountains. He said, les boys, in English. It means, the trees, the trees. I read that and thought of the late actor Hervé Villechaize. I intend to do some research to see if a similar anecdote exists about the guide who named the plains. But Boise's almost struck me as sexist, and changing the name to Girlsy won't help. Let's call it Folksy. Latrobe here is named after Benjamin Henry Latrobe, or Latrobe as the Latrobians say, the architect who in 1812 built the U.S. Capitol after the dastardly Brits burnt it down. I'm fine with Latrobe, but in a town that already has the Arnold Palmer Airport, Arnold Palmer Drive, Arnold Palmer Cadillac, once upon a time, the Arnold Palmer Hotel, and Once Upon a Time, Arnold Palmer himself. I think we can come up with something more appropriate, don't you? Like, welcome to Happyville. That brings us to Pittsburgh. If ever a town has been in need of a new name, it's the one that's closest to my heart. Nothing described with the word pit is desirable. No one's ever said, hey, I found a really great pit. Bring a bottle of wine, some sandwiches, and we'll have a picnic. Mob informants are buried in shallow pits. Most things described with pit, armpits, pit stops, are things that stink. Let's face it, most of the pits are the pits, and that to me includes actors named Brad. Pittsburgh was in 1758 named by General John Forbes in honor of his friend William Pitt, who decreed that it shall be called Pittsburgh forever. Or was it Pittsburgh without an H? Our H comes and goes throughout the history. Some years were Pittsburgh with an H, some were Pittsburgh with no H. I think just to mess with people, the mayor should decree that henceforth Pittsburgh will be spelled with Pittsburgh with two H's, and that we'll be adding an additional H every 10 years until the year 2054, when we'll forever be called Pittsburgh. I have an even better idea. Let's put Pitt in the pit and bestow the city with a transcendent name that perfectly depicts how we've come up and dealt with our ups and downs and the jokes of lazy poets who realize that Pittsburgh rhymes with a scatological pejorative. It's a name that can be loved by all of us. Yes, it's time Pittsburgh changed its name to Copesburg. That would be the perfect way to honor screechy sports announcer and inventor of the tire Botal, Myron Cope. In Pittsburgh, we not only do Cope, we love Cope. Our love for him will never be surpassed. He was warm, hilarious, and philanthropic. And he was one hell of a writer, too, a fact that's often overlooked. So join me in declaring that Pittsburgh is from now on Copesburg. Oh, who am I kidding? The idea doesn't stand a snowball's chance in uninhabitable. I wonder if it ever bothered Jesus his birthday was the same day as Christmas. A 1979 song Paul McCartney wrote in one afternoon will again earn him more than $400,000 this year for a cumulative total of more than $17 million. Yes, for Sir Paul, it's always a wonderful Christmas time. By contrast, this will be the 2,242nd blog post I've ever written since 2007. A steadfast tally that's earned me exactly $104 in support of donations. Wonderful Christmas time is controversial around the Rodell family dinner table. And if that statement has you concluding dinner conversation at my table ain't exactly a Bill Maher roundtable, you're correct. It's the four of us sitting around listening to Christmas music, discussing our days and trying to guess who it was that farted. I'm kidding. I'm the only one that farts. But conversation gets pointed when Paul McCartney's Wonderful Christmas Time comes on. I find it pleasant enough, but Val hates it, and she says that nearly every time it comes on. I hate this song, she says, practically seething. It's just so annoying. I don't love it, but I always admonish her for viciousness towards something so innocuous as a little Christmas ditty. I have my hatred for true evil, things like ISIL, Injustice, and Roger Goodell. It's surprising to me how some songs about our most joyful holiday can be so divisive. The Wikipedia entry on the song says many consider it one of Paul's poorest composition and quotes author Robert Rodriguez as saying, songs within the McCartney oeuvre have provoked such strong reactions. Come on, it's a Christmas song. If we as a people allow Christmas carols to divide us, how will we ever remain united when we decide as a country on some distant day that maybe, maybe, it's time to thoughtfully and with open minds discuss things like how to decrease gun violence. Even if you don't like the melody, there is much to admire about the tune. It's catchy. It's simple. Its runtime doesn't exceed 3 minutes. The lyrics include ding, dong, ding, dong, ding, dong, dong, ding, and ooh, ooh, toot, 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 toot. Here's something you probably didn't know. The track personnel is listed as follows. Vocals, Paul McCartney. Guitar, Paul McCartney. Bass, Paul McCartney. Keyboards, Paul McCartney. Drums, Paul McCartney. Percussion, It's Paul McCartney. I guess Paul McCartney worried just calling it the Paul McCartney Band would have come across as too pretentious. I love Paul. He's my second favorite Beatle behind George. On anyone. I hope for the sake of our collective cool, we never refer to Ringo as the last surviving Beatle. Hey Jude, yesterday, let it be, live and let die. Paul's songs are indelible. He's reportedly worth in excess of $660 million, which is just shy of the gross national product of the nation of Guam, population 165,124. And geez, a $15 million drop in that bucket comes from a song many tasteful listeners despise. A throwaway that probably took him less time to write than it takes me to sort through a week's recyclables. In fact, I probably took more care in crafting this stupid little Monday morning blog than the great Sir Paul did in the entire composition of Wonderful Christmas Time. And for that, he gets $15 million, and I get squat. No dough, no recognition. My wife's right. That song is just so fucking annoying. For the day. Ask people if they think Jesus was bothered that his birthday was the same day as Christmas. This is about the Sound of Music and two of my favorite things at Christmas time. I always puzzle over how The Sound of Music, a movie that has more to do with Nazis than either Christ or Santa, became a Christmas staple. It offends the part of me that seeks a life of logic. But that part of me is puny compared to the sentimental part of me that every year enjoys watching The Sound of Music at Christmas. So these are a few of my favorite Christmas things. Stringing tree popcorn while watching Polar Express. It's odd that somehow things become quirky family traditions. I don't even remember how this one started. I'm not even a huge Polar Express fan, finding the animation creepy and knowing the entire holiday vibe will be detonated when the animated Steven Tyler shows up riding his unicycle. Heck, I don't even like stringing popcorn. It combines both tediousness and self-inflicted pain. Yet every year I look forward to sitting with the girls and watching one of my least favorite movies while doing something I find boring and painful. Ah, the power of the family tradition. I enjoy the Christmas pop-in. I made an afternoon run yesterday of stopping to see friends at work during times when they'd usually be upset to see me, ruining their unscheduled appearance. I never stay long, but I think delivering what is essentially a living greeting card is welcome. Another one of my favorite things, hearing the Kinks play Father Christmas. It's just perfectly subversive. It's about rough children who threaten to beat up Santa if he brings them toys instead of dough. And man, that song really rocks. Apparently, it's too contrary for the seasonal sweetness for radio programmers. I never hear it even on satellite radio. Doesn't matter. I'll hear it about 40 times between now and Sunday. I love listening to crime old-time radio shows on satellite radio. Val and I both relish long drives without the kids this time of year so we can hear our old favorite Christmas stories told on the golden age of radio. My favorites, Gunsmoke, Dragnet, and Suspense. I'll sit in the driveway for 15 minutes hearing Sergeant Friday solve the crime of who stole the statue of the baby Jesus from the missionary altar. And with my crayons book. I make mental notes of people I've met throughout the year who've either been extra kind or shared some personal hardship with me. Then I take them each signed copies of my book. The cheerful little book has made, over the years, many people happy, and that makes me very happy. I like watching old Christmas time episodes of our favorite TV shows. Cheers, All in the Family, The Andy Griffith Show, Bob Newhart. They all have great ones. Same goes for old Christmas movies. We love We're No Angels, The Waltons' Homecoming, and watching It's a Wonderful Life is as meaningful as anything you'll hear in church. One of my favorite things about Christmas is how the entire world seems to, even for 1 week, awaken to my leisurely priorities. Work becomes less important than cheerful conversation. Yes, raindrops on roses, whiskers on kittens, bright copper kettles, warm woolen mittens. These are a few of my favorite things. Just one more, and I'm saving the best for last. Thank God, pretty soon it'll all be over. The Christmas season inspires so many questions. Was the virgin birth real? Is Jesus the true Son of God? Will there ever be peace on earth? I have a question. How did Charlie Brown ever get that sweater over his huge bulbous head? Last Christmas joke. Gather the kids around and tell them you have some heartbreaking news. Then, holding back the tears, say, Grandma got run over by a reindeer. I hope you'll join me next week for another episode of Use All the Crayons, the podcast.
John Jamison, retired sheep farmer, Crabtree, Pennsylvania. My colorful living tip of the day is learn the fine art of knowing precisely when to quit.
Thank you.
Yes.